This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Major Steve Beck is a Marine. His job? To inform families of Marines killed in the line of duty. The job is called casualty notification. Major Beck calls it the most important mission of his life. On the program today, the story of fallen soldiers, Major Beck, and the families he's called on. Our guest is Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Jim Sheeler. He's the author of Final Salute, A Story of Unfinished Lives. Sheeler introduces readers to Major Beck at the outset of the book. He's about to knock on a door. Sheeler notes that simple act has the power to shatter a soul. He writes, Marines are trained to kill. They are known for their blank stare and an allegiance to their unofficial motto, no greater friend, no worse enemy. Since 2003, as the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan intensified, Marines such as Major Beck found themselves catapulted into a duty they never trained for, a mission without weapons. Those words from Jim Sheeler's book, Final Salute, a book dedicated to all those who opened the door. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon. You can join us with questions and comments. Here are the phone numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number, that number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-9455. WILL. Jim Sheeler's book, Final Salute, A Story of Unfinished Lives, grew out of a story he wrote for the Rocky Mountain News, which won the 2006 Pulitzer Prize for feature writing. Sheeler has specialized in covering the impact of war at home for the paper since Colorado's first casualty of war in Iraq. The book, Final Salute, published by Penguin, a portion of the proceeds from Final Salute are being donated to charities supporting military families. And again, the phone number is 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Jim Sheeler, good to talk with you. How are you?
Very well. Thanks for inviting me.
Sure, my pleasure. A duty they never trained for, a mission without weapons. How do they prepare for this duty, casualty notification?
Well, it's really changed over the since the war began. In the beginning, for Major Beck's first notification, he really had no training. There is a casualty manual, but it's written in kind of a dry, bureaucratic language that really doesn't offer too much guidance, especially not from the emotional side. So he got the first call, and it was just on his cell phone saying he had a casualty. And once they receive the call, the goal is to notify the family within 4 hours. They want to reach the family before any word gets out through the rumor mill or to the media to make sure that the family, that they get their information from those Marines who will arrive. And the families know that if they get a personal visit, that's what it's for. They're told that if they get a call, it could be an injury, but if they get that personal visit, then the worst has happened.
Yeah. Beck told you when they see you coming, they know.
Yes. He says they do. They always know. And really, it's just a matter of kind of tapping their own humanity. I mean, at the same time, as you said, Major Beck was, his real job was training Marine reservists to go to Iraq. So, you know, on one hand, you know, you've just trained these guys to break down doors and shoot, and then you get a cell phone call and you have the exact opposite duty. You have to go perform the most delicate duty that there is and completely switch mindsets. And he actually went and asked some other guys from another branch who had done casualty notification how to do it, and their feeling was that it should be very quick and impersonal. And they said, don't touch the families, don't hug them. And he said, I didn't have any use for those people. I knew that I was going to do this the way that I would want it done if I was the one who had died, if it was the Marines who had come to talk to my wife, what would I want them to say? And that's what he had to say.
Yeah, he's really passionate about doing this right.
He is. He feels, I think it's, he's a fascinating character because he wanted to go to Iraq so badly, you know, that he wanted to be over there with the men he calls his brothers. And instead of going to Iraq, he ended up with this duty. And I think he comes to realize that it's just as important, if not more important, than some of the things they're doing in Iraq, because it's taking care of these families the way that that they would want them taken care of.
Hmm. You tell readers that if we were to ask a Marine about this particular duty, he or she would say they'd rather be in the danger zone. They'd rather be under fire than to have to approach a front door. How is one selected for this assignment?
It's really anybody who is a ranking officer above the deceased can be tapped for this duty. Now they have officers who have gone through some training courses, either by video or computer or in person, it's still, according to Major Beck, it's not really something that can be taught. It's something that's just within you. And so just because of that, I mean, you can't really select for empathy. And so some go better than others. And it just depends on who it is that's doing the informing. And in Major Beck's case, he had lived a life where he had seen a lot of death and learned to talk to families who were grieving and kind of seemed to know the right words long before he became a Marine.
Hmm. What led him to the Marine Corps?
His father was a Marine, and he had always kind of had a fascination with it, as many Marines that I've talked to ended up. He wanted to go to medical school, and he wanted the Marines to pay for it, so he ended up joining up, and he never ended up going to medical school. He's become basically a career officer. He's almost at 20 years now.
Yeah. One of the things that he told you about this job, this mission, is all I can do is catch the family while they're falling.
Yes.
What does that entail?
Well, he says that once the family sees him at the door, I mean, the reactions really range from just screaming to some families refuse to let them in. Some mothers will lock the door and have to be coaxed to open the door. They feel that, you know, the longer they put off the news, that the longer it is that it hasn't happened. So he says that when they do finally see him, he says he can see it in their eyes that something sinks, and he has to catch them. He says something sinks. It's not as much their heart, but part of their soul that sinks. And in catching them, it means not only catching them in that moment, but all the moments afterwards. The knock itself really just begins the process that's going to last that family for the rest of their lives. And everything from the funeral to bringing the body back to all the reams of paperwork that they're going to have to deal with to the things that when the Marine's remains return from Iraq, that can sometimes be months later. He will bring those boxes of things to the family and go through them with them if they want them to, reading those last letters, going through those uniforms that the families now have that are empty.
Does he continue to be a part of many of these families' lives for a long, long time?
He does. He's now stationed at the Pentagon, but every time he comes back to Colorado, he meets with the families. And, I mean, one of the things that struck me when I was interviewing him, we followed him for about 9 months, and we were sitting waiting at an airport for a body to arrive, and I noticed that on his cell phone, he had all the families that he had informed on his speed dial. And he still does. He still has those families' numbers on there. And they will still call him if they have a question. They know that they can call him if there's some bureaucratic hoop that needs to be helped along by somebody who knows the language, then they can call him. And he wants to have that connection for the rest of their lives. He feels that connection that he's made by being at that doorstep is a connection that will never be broken. And for many of these families, it has not.
Yeah. Maybe now we could talk about Catherine Cathy.
Sure.
I'm wondering, you know, if she might give him a call and say, if you're in the area, stop by for a birthday.
Sure.
December 22nd is coming up. If you're going to be around, come over.
Sure. The Catherine Cathy, I met her after probably about 3 days after Major Beck informed her that her husband had died in Iraq. And Todd Heisler, the photographer who also won the Pulitzer Prize and whose photos are in the book and who came along with me on this journey, we both went to her house and met with her for several hours. This was maybe 3 days after her husband died, and one day after she found out that her baby was going to be a boy that she was pregnant with. And after talking with her that night, something really struck me when she brought out a baby blanket. Because she was talking about Jim. All these families have this in common. They want their sons' husbands' stories told. They want the stories out there. They want their picture on the front page the next day. And so Catherine talked to us up until midnight that night, until basically her parents had to tell us to leave, because she wanted to talk about Jim. It's the one thing that they're comfortable talking about. And so she brought out this baby blanket that she still cherished, and she said that when Jim was at officer candidate school, she had started knitting. And when she found out that the baby was on the way, she would start knitting baby blankets and baby booties. And the night before Jim left, he knew that he wouldn't be back home in time to see the baby born, but he wanted to leave the baby something. So the night before he left, he slept with that baby blanket because when the baby was born, he wanted him to know how he smelled. And for me, that said so much. You think of these Marines as these, you know, hard-faced, breakdown doors, walls of muscle. But there's also these poetic moments like that of sleeping with the baby blanket to know how he smelled. And that was the lead to my story the next day. The soft blue-green baby blanket still smells like Second Lieutenant James J. Cathy. And from then on, we asked Catherine if we could tag along with her throughout the whole process of bringing Jim home. And it turned into this amazing story of devotion and love and compassion from the Marines and Catherine and the families that still just gives me shivers.
Yeah. There's so much here that is sad. There's so much here to mourn. On the other hand, there's a lot of hope here.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, there's so many of these little moments that are just beautiful. I mean, that last night that Catherine had with Jim, the night before his funeral, she decided that the last night they had spent together, she didn't feel like it should have been their last night. And so she asked the Marines if she could sleep with him in the funeral home. And they blew up a mattress for her and set it up as a bed right in front of the casket. And she slept there that night. And we were there all night. And when she woke up the next morning, she said it was the best night of sleep she had had since he died. Mm-hmm. And then they went to bury him. But those poetic moments are the things that that really do give you hope. You know, once again, the Marines, there's these young Marines who were there at the funeral and at Jim Cathy's funeral. And at the end of the funeral, they brought out these bags of black sand. And I asked one of the Marines about it, and he said, well, when we were training in Hawaii, we took a trip to Iwo Jima, and we slept on the beach there, and we all took these bags of sand, and we've kept them with us ever since then, not knowing what we would do with them. And at the end of the funeral, they took their bags of sand and they sprinkled them on Jim Cathy's casket. And he said, this comes from that place where all those Marines died. Now he can be part of them too. You know, it is. It's amazing when you hear that coming from a 22-year-old who's just come back from the war. And there are those moments that will stay with me forever.
Yeah. And there's you write about the scene in the mortuary the night before. Two Marines making up this bed for Catherine. And one says to the other, "Make it look nice, dude. Make it look nice." And the other one shoots back with a big grin, "Who are you, Martha Stewart?"
Right.
And
then they
look at one another, and somebody asks, "If you're pregnant, do you get hot or cold?" I mean, they're thinking, how can they make her comfortable?
Exactly. Yeah. Exactly. And you know, there is some levity, you know. I mean, amidst all the crying, there is a lot of laughter at times too. And then it'll go from crying to laughter to these incredibly quiet but very touching moments, such as Catherine sleeping there. And she, like I said, she wanted people to see that. She wanted people to know about her and Jim's last night together. I mean, she actually looked up at one point at the Marine who was watching over her that night, because the Marines will stay there, stay and post guard 24 hours a day if the body is accessible to the public. And she looked up at him, and she said, "Are my reporters still here?" And he said, "Yeah, they're out in the pews in the dark. Do you want me to get rid of them?" And she said, "No, I just wanted to make sure they were here."
Mm.
So, you know, these moments, they are incredibly personal, but a lot of the families really do want to share them with the entire country to let them know that this is what this is a small part of what they're going through.
Yeah. And they want you to know about who their soldier was. So maybe you should tell us a little bit about James Jimmy Cathy.
Sure. Like I said, he was a pretty amazing kid all through high school. He's one of those kids who is so smart that it got him into trouble. He was one of the Marines referred to him as the smartest dumb guy I ever met, because he had that sort of natural intelligence that allowed him to goof off in school and get into trouble. But also he had a devotion to the Marine Corps, and he had since he was a boy when he would go out hunting with his dad. And so he actually was accepted into the Corps and skipped his high school graduation to go to boot camp. And then he was stationed in Hawaii and was an infantry Marine, you know, kind of the front line guys. And people started seeing his intelligence and realized, you're officer material. And it's very rare for somebody who's enlisted to become an officer, but he decided that he would do that. And so he did go back to school, and he came to the University of Colorado and then went to training in Quantico and went over to Iraq as a second lieutenant, commanding those same infantry Marines that he once was, which really endeared him to his men. And, you know, he would still call his father all the time and from, you know, whenever he could. And his father said that still he'll pick up the phone and expect to hear that, "Hey, Dad." And so now he says he finds himself. He'll pick up the phone and he'll say, "Hey, Dad," before he realizes it's him saying it and not his son.
Yeah, he's had a tough time of it, too.
He has. His father struggles with depression, and so he had already had a hard time with it, his son leaving before his son was killed. And, you know, the day afterwards, his wife, Jim's mom, had to actually make sure that when he went to their old hunting grounds that he didn't have his gun with him, because he said he might have ended it because he wanted to join his son and he wouldn't be alone.
Mm. I think we should also talk here about the other men that you profile in the book: Christopher Anderson, Kyle Burns, Brett Lee Lundstrom, Jesse Givens. This is kind of unfair, in a sense, to sum up these guys in a radio program like this, but give it your best shot. Tell us a little about something about each one of them.
Okay. Kyle Burns was a he was actually proud to call himself just kind of your typical redneck kid from Wyoming, and he was this tobacco chewing he would squirrel away the tins of tobacco in his Humvee, but he was also the kind of guy who would make people laugh with these just goofy jokes. Like, his favorite joke was, why was 6 afraid of 7? Because 7, 8, 9, you know, little things like that. You know, it's, he was very simple, but also, you know, he played hockey and, you know, in the middle of Wyoming, you know, he was both into hunting and hockey, ice hockey. Just a tough little kid, and he definitely had my admiration for that. Doc Anderson is also an amazing story. He joined as a corpsman, joined the Navy. His dad was a Navy SEAL, which is the special forces of the Navy, basically, and so he had grown up with that, and he knew that if he was going to join the Navy, that it had to be something special. So he joined as a corpsman, which for me seems like about the most noble job there is, almost in one of the entire military, which they're basically medics for the Marines. The Marines don't have their own medics, so they borrow them from the Navy. So there are these corpsmen who are assigned to Marine units, and they're not Marines, but the Marines come to treat them as Marines because they have to do everything the Marines are doing, carry weapons and everything, plus all the medical gear. Doc Anderson had all of his buddies' medical records in his head, and he saved his sergeant's life a couple of months before he died. His sergeant lost both legs, part of an arm, and was pockmarked all through his body with shrapnel, and yet Chris managed to save him, and I met him at Arlington, and he came with his two daughters to the cemetery in a wheelchair, but he made it. He said he wouldn't have missed it for anything because his doc had saved his life, and he was one of the best Marines he had ever known.
Mm.
Let's see, Jesse Givens, I think, actually let me talk about Brett first. Brett Lundstrom was the first Lakota Sioux to die in Iraq, and his family was kind enough to let us into the 48-hour wake at the Pine Ridge Indian Reservation, where we really learned a new definition of honor and how to really remember somebody. People from all over the reservation walked, hitchhiked, everything they could to get to the gymnasium of the high school, where they the Marines brought his body. Active duty Marines brought his body to the town, and then the warriors, the old Indian warriors, Lakota, transferred his body to an old clapboard wagon and pulled it by horse to the gymnasium where they had set up a huge teepee. And at night they would wheel Brett's body into the teepee so he could communicate with the Lakota spirits. And in the daytime, they would bring him out so everybody could come and kiss him and play their drums. And his grandfather, his great uncle, who he called his grandfather, during the ceremony, gave Brett his official Lakota Indian name, which is now and will always be Lone Eagle. Mm. And then there's Jesse Givens, who still, I think, he's one of those guys who completely shatters all stereotypes. Before he joined the Army, he was a security guard at Shopko. Then he was an iron worker, and then he was a private in the Army. And all of those carry with them these stereotypes of, you know, what kind of a person he was. But to me, he was a writer. He wrote these amazing letters home to his sons. He had one son that he knew who was 5 years old when he died, and another son that was on the way, who he just referred to as Bean, because on the sonogram when he left, that's all that they could make out was this little thing that looked like a bean. Mm-hmm. So he would write to Bean as if that was the name. And if I could, I could just read part of his letters, because I think, is that okay?
Yeah, that would be great. And there's the, there's also this wonderful photo of his last letter.
Yes.
In the book.
Yes.
Yeah.
He actually was killed when they were trying to put out fires that insurgents had set. And they were trying to put them out by running over the fires with tanks, and it was in the middle of the night, and his tank rolled over a berm and into a canal, and the tank flipped over, and they were trapped inside the tank, and he actually drowned in the tank, which his wife couldn't believe when they told her.
Yeah.
She just said, you can't drown in the desert.
Right.
But he did. But before he did, he would write these letters to his family, these just-in-case letters. And I could just read you the letter to Dakota and the letter to Bean. I think they're more beautiful than anything I've ever written or ever will. But the Dakota letter starts off, Dakota, you were more son than I could ever ask for. I could only hope I was half the dad. You taught me how to care until it hurts. You taught me how to smile again. You taught me that life isn't so serious and sometimes you have to play. You have a big, beautiful heart. Through life, you need to keep it open and follow it. Never be afraid to be yourself. I will always be there in our park when you dream so we can still play together. I hope someday you will have a son like mine. Make them smile and shine just like you. I hope someday you will understand why I didn't come home. Please be proud of me. Please don't stop loving life. Take in every breath like it's your first. I will always be there with you. I'll be in the sun, shadows, dreams, and joys of your life. And then his letter to the baby Bean that he never got to see. Bean, I never got to see you, but I know in my heart you are beautiful. I will always have with me the feel of the soft nudges on your mom's belly and the joy I felt when we found out you were on the way. I dream of you every night, and I always will. Don't ever think that since I wasn't around that I didn't love you. You were conceived of love, and I came to this terrible place for love. Please understand that I had to be gone so that I could take care of my family. I love you, Bean. Mm. One of the things that has been good for me has been being able to see little Bean, little Carson grow up, and Jim Cathy's baby, Jimmy, growing up. You know, I can still keep in touch with these families because, you know, they still mean a lot to me, too. And I talked to them first before writing the book, and they said that they wanted me to, that they wanted those stories in there. And there are so many other stories that I've written, you know, over 5 years. I've been to way too many funerals and heard way too many stories like this, but I had to narrow them down and have these guys represent everybody else that that I've been there for as to watch their funerals.
Mm-hmm. Journalist Jim Sheeler is our guest in this portion of the Afternoon Magazine. He's the author of Final Salute, a story of unfinished lives. Our guest is a reporter with the Rocky Mountain News, and this book, Final Salute, grew out of stories he wrote for the paper, and they won the 2006 Pulitzer Prize for feature writing. The book also includes some amazing photographs taken by Todd Heisler, who also won a Pulitzer Prize for his work. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Let's talk with a listener now in Urbana on line one. Hi.
Hello.
Hello.
Yes. Don't you have some misgivings about this? I'm not sure that you're picturing these people as doing something heroic, but certainly it was tragic that they died, and yet it was for no cause, because we now know the war was entered under completely false pretenses. And if you count the mercenaries, 5,000 Americans have died, and probably a million Iraqis for no point. How do you deal with that?
I'm basically writing down what I saw, and I think that a book like this should raise questions. But it's not going to provide answers. But I think people need to know that these men and women are out there, that these families are sacrificing. And if I was not to write this down, that would not keep it from happening. So I tried to be as apolitical in the story as I could. If families have political views, I let them voice them instead of me. I feel that there was one point in the book where a mother challenged Major Beck. She said, was my son's life worth it? Was it worth this? And he told her, Betty, with all you've been through, that's not a question I can answer for you. That's a question that you have to answer for yourself. And I think that if you take this book and many others and other research that you can do and put that into your own mind, that we should all form our own conclusions. But that doesn't mean that we should devalue the service and the sacrifice of these guys.
Well, for a sacrifice, you must give something up for something. And they were not giving... They were giving something up, but for not the end they were told they were making a sacrifice for.
Well, I would argue that
didn't constitute a danger, and therefore they're not defending our safety. They're not doing anything for us. It is complete futility, and that's tragic. This reminds me of Shakespeare's Hamlet, where the prince... I think he's of Denmark, marches off into Poland to fight over 100 square feet of soil that's utterly worthless.
Well, I think you could argue that they're doing what their commander-in-chief told them to do, what the commander-in-chief that this country elected told them to do. And so that's why we all have a role in it.
That's one of the things that I want to thank the listener for his call. That's one of the things that you get into in the book in terms of the politics of these wars. And that is something that Major Steve Beck says he tries to walk around that. He said politics should be set aside. Give us his point of view on this.
Yeah, he feels that it's, that no matter how you feel about the war itself, that we should have some sort of a connection to it, an emotional connection. It should hurt when we see one of those names go across the screen. We should pause for longer than a second to say, oh, that's one more in the tally, because there are hundreds of people who are going to be impacted for the rest of their lives from that one explosion, that one knock. And, the politics do enter into it, but I think that he feels that the emotion should be just as strong, that he says that when he gives that flag, that folded flag to the grieving mother, and he says on behalf of a grateful nation, that he should be able to say that with confidence, that it is from a grateful nation.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Again, our guest is Jim Sheeler, author of Final Salute, A Story of Unfinished Lives. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Another place that where the war is quite controversial and very unpopular is on the Pine Ridge Reservation. But as you alluded to earlier, those who serve are very much honored. Maybe you could talk with us a little bit about that.
Sure, yeah. Actually, Native Americans have the highest per capita participation in the military of any other ethnic group. Lori Piestewa was the first, she was a Hopi Indian, she was the first female casualty of war on foreign soil that we've had. The honor for someone who has served not only their country, but their community is huge. And it's, you know, you think of that paradox. And I talked to some of the older veterans from World War II in Korea, and said, after all the country has done, they say that actually, you know, after all the country has done to them, people still ask them, you know, why would they be so willing to go and fight? And they just said it's part of the warrior tradition. It's part of being proud. And actually, at Pine Ridge, they also feel that ever since Crazy Horse took that flag from Custer, that it's also become theirs in a different way. So they assign a different type of respect for the flag, one that's mixed with their own blood and eagle feathers and drumming that continues and sweat lodges where they go and really respect. They really showed me a new way to remember, which was not to grieve and mourn, to do that, but also to celebrate this life. And by having those drums going on for 48 hours straight and having these people staying up bringing everything they had to this gymnasium and giving it to the family, it was just a sense of a real community remembering.
Hmm. How did you come to cover the impact of war here at home, and how and why did the Rocky Mountain News make such a commitment to?
Was actually just assigned. I was a new reporter at the Rocky when the first casualties began coming in, and I was assigned to cover the funeral of the first Coloradan killed. His name was Tommy Slocum, and during his funeral, I just started seeing things that I thought needed to be seen by everybody, and that I would start reporting aspects of the war from places where people weren't going, to follow up with the families, to continue reading, listening to the widows read the last letters, and do stories on the kids whose fathers aren't going to come home. Dakota Givens, actually, the Givens family, they still celebrate his birthday, Jesse's birthday. And they do it by blowing up helium balloons and writing messages on them. And then they take them out into the backyard, and they let them go where Dakota says the balloons will go up to heaven where his dad can read them. And Dakota actually asked his mom once if when he does die and go to heaven, if he can still be 5 years old, so his dad can still give him piggyback rides. That's what I wanted to start showing people, that it doesn't end, that this is the commitment that the country has made. No matter what your feelings on the war, these families are the ones who are bearing that burden. And I decided to go ahead and write these stories and continue to write them and continue to follow up. And it turns out that it doesn't end. That the mother of the first Coloradan who died, Tommy Slocum, his mother still goes to every funeral of every Marine who's died from Colorado, because she says her own sons was such a blur that she forgot part of it, most of it. And by going and seeing these other funerals, it brings back glimpses of what she went through when she was sitting up in that chair.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that is very important to Major Beck is that we are not detached from these people and
exactly.
and their stories, and we are not detached from what we are doing as a nation. I would think he would say that, maybe.
I think he would exactly say that.
Yeah.
They used to bring the flag-draped caskets home on commercial aircraft, and he made a big ceremony at the airport, made it a point of having a very formal ceremony, of having those Marines out on the tarmac to go up into the belly of the plane and retrieve that flag-draped casket, and having the passengers watch as they were bringing the casket down and into the hearse, that... you know, he wanted them to know that they just flew with a dead service member and that they should remember that flight for the rest of their life. They're now officially part of the war in a way that they weren't before. And that's a feeling that he feels that, that all of us should have to some degree of having this emotional tie of, you know, this does hurt me, and it should. And no matter what you think of the war, if you don't acknowledge the sacrifice of these families who some of their husbands or sons are on their third or fourth deployment, and they could be getting that knock any moment, but yet to go ahead and to live their life just day to day, that the least we could do is take a moment every day, each time you see one of those names. I mean, it's not that difficult to go up and look up on the internet and see who that person was, and take 10 minutes to find it out, or go to a funeral. I mean, pull your kid out of school and go to one of these military funerals. I mean, the first ones were standing room only, jam packed in the cemeteries, and now when I go to them, it's usually just families and friends. But I think that strangers should go to these funerals because really the person in that casket isn't a stranger.
It also causes one to pause and think about the actions of our civilian political leaders and how we are responsible for them.
Absolutely. Yeah. I think that that's a big part of it. I mean, they're the ones who are making that final decision, but we're the ones who put them there and gave them the chance to do that.
Mm. What are Major Beck's feelings about the war?
His personal beliefs are that the policies have been correct. He definitely admits the mistakes, tactical mistakes, but he believes in the overall mission, both in Iraq and Afghanistan.
Yeah. It seems to me that there's a lot of disagreement among military people about whether this was right or wrong and how it's been conducted.
Sure. Yeah. Definitely. Of the Marines and soldiers and sailors I've talked to, definitely there's disagreement. The one thing there's not disagreement about is the honor that they're going to give their buddies, and that at the very least, you know, that they'll say this is what they signed up to do for everybody else who's not doing it. And at the very, very least, they're fighting for the guy right next to them. They'll put the big picture out of the picture, and you know, in order to keep their sanity, a lot of times they'll just say, I'm not interested in what the commander's decisions are. All I'm interested in is keeping myself and my friends alive.
Mm. What are your thoughts about one of the things that you talk about a little bit in the author's note at the end of the book is the Iraqis? You want to wrap up here with some thoughts about those folks half a world away who are also in great pain, perhaps, you know, I mean, we don't hear as much about them. They live every day, you know, in a war zone.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think that, I would never want it thought that I believe I don't think Major Beck would is either. And I've heard Marines say that their lives are not worth more than any of the Iraqis who are over there. And I think that the problem, for the most part, has been that that it's been so difficult to get out and tell those stories of the regular Iraqis and the funerals just like these that are going on over there. But absolutely, that's one of the things I say in the author's note, is that I hope their story is told in the same way at some point when we have a chance to, that those lives are recognized as well, because they are no less important.
There we have to leave it. Jim, thank you very much for talking with me this afternoon.
Thank you so much.
Jim Sheeler is the author of Final Salute, A Story of Unfinished Lives. Our guest is a winner of the Pulitzer Prize. He is a reporter for the Rocky Mountain News. He has specialized in covering the impact of war at home for the newspaper since Colorado's first casualty of war in Iraq. The book is published by Penguin. A portion of the proceeds from Final Salute are being donated to charities supporting military families. Final Salute, again, the publisher is Penguin.